incredibly comprehensive talk, Brian. You covered a vast range of topics and gave us a vast amount of food for thought. I think everybody would agree with that. So can we, without further ado... Can we, without further ado, see if there are any questions or comments? I'm sure there must be. Vast amount to think about there. Yeah, Mark.
Yeah. I suppose I just want maybe kick off just with a question, Brian, on the analysis you gave with regard to the champagne glass model with the global population and the top 10%. It just occurred to me it would be worth trying to. I mean, my instinct would be that probably the whole population of the UK is within that 10% in global terms. I don't know whether that's the case, but I was thinking in global, very often in global terms, when you say how much people earn per day in the, you know, poorer parts of the world compared to the richer parts, it makes all of us seem like millionaires. And so I just don't know what the, because that doesn't represent a given country, that, like England, that represents the global population as a whole. So, you know, I'm just thinking that would probably be, we would probably need to because that would also relate to the impact upon the working class in Europe and North America, so the richer parts of the world, and the degree to which our consumption would have to change. We're assuming Richard Branson would have to reduce his consumption, but I'm just thinking that we would need to look at that a bit more, and I don't know the answer.
I take your point. I think the average, I always find it interesting that they, if you take the global wealth, so not savings and shares and such like, but actual income, whether it's from wages or salaries or share dividends or rent or whatever.
Brian, could you stand up?
Surely. Yeah, surely. I always find it surprising when you look at, you know, we know this vast disparity in wealth around the world, and, you know, billions of people on a few dollars a day, but also at the other end, this massive high levels of wealth. And when you average it all out, not that socialism means we'll average it all out and give everybody the same wage, of course, but when you, just to get some sort of reference, when you do that, what does it actually come to? What is the average person's income? So the average household, two parents, their average income is about $27,000 US dollars. The unit is PPP, which is, I always forget what it was, it's purchasing power parity. Yeah, thanks. So an equivalent if you were spending the money in the US. And it always surprises me that just how, you know, so if you were to average all the money out, every household would essentially have $27,000 to spend. It's always quite an eye opener there. So I mean, the point about where the UK sits in terms of real GDP, and obviously every country has a different population. So if you're looking at it per capita, per person, that shifts it a little bit as well. But I've got a graph here. I can't show it up on there, unfortunately, but. It doesn't actually show the UK. Now, certainly, we are way up. We are, I think, you know, fourth or fifth richest country in the world. So we're certainly way up at one end. But I think the point I was making was just, you know, that the whole argument is all the graphs that the climate change committee, the panel on climate change show. It's all about countries. It's all showing here's the poor countries down here, and here's the rich countries here, and it's actually missing the real resolution, which is that, you know, when you do it by wealth, it's an even more extreme plot that you get, because you're going down to the very poorest and away up to the very richest as well. I'm not sure I answered your question, but
I was just saying the assumption was that the richest 10% would be more like the richest 10% of our society. It's on a global scale, we are much higher up, all of us, than a lot of other people. So I was thinking that obviously our own consumption would change. We've already discussed that, even with regard to meat consumption. It just
I did just, if I can just get this back, as I'm not going back, I'll just go forward. I did. This is from the two-hour talk. It's very difficult to sort of get. You can get access to some models and put in some sort of figures here and there, but it's not the sophisticated, powerful models, so you're only looking at the very one thing and what other thing here. I did sort of ask this question. I didn't show it in the talk that I gave because it sort of begs more questions than it answers, but I'm just sort of wondering if you're saying that the average income per person is something like down around about here, $13,000 PPP for the average person in the planet, you know, can you look at some sort of convergence of wealth over a period of time? So this could be, say, 5-year, 10, 15, 20-year period, a sort of generational period, perhaps, of looking at there. And so you've got your richest 10% who are averaging 35,000. You've got your poorest 50%. Sorry, 20% here. You've got your poorest 50% who are averaging around about 5,000. You've got your middle 30% who are averaging, you know, 12,000 or something like that. And then you've got your richest 20% who are up at the 35,000 there. And what would it involve if we were to try and converge at some point in the future? Now, this is all very, I can understand people's unease about this, but nonetheless, it's the reason for doing this is saying what's the implications for CO2 emissions, perhaps. Now, not looking at population, that's a conflicting factor here as well, and obviously GDP influences population as well. So we're really only looking at one variable. So, if there was a sudden over 5-year reduction down to 27,000, which is double the current average income. So if the rich people all came down to that sort of level, and then these two groups here have a sort of staggered rise up. I guess the point we're making here is it's not going to happen overnight. It cannot happen overnight. But, this might be some sort of model that we'd be looking to or aspiring to. A generational change, very significant changes. Are these poor people down here, are they going to be disgruntled with that? Are they going to want the standard living immediately? Well, I think we've got to say, our revolution is predicated on socialist consciousness that it's going to take time, we're going to have to make it work. And, this isn't going to happen overnight. But what they will see is immediate changes in terms of, education and health and such, like immediate improvements within a few years. And then an attention towards some sort of convergence. Now, what all this, if you add it all up, I won't go into the measurements behind it, but basically, if you take this as being a 25-year period, then this would involve a rise in GDP, all else being equal, so assuming there's no other change to GDP, this convergence would mean a rise of about 5% per year, which is quite a lot for capitalism. It goes along at 2 or 3% per year. So that's quite a rise in the economic activity. But it wouldn't be all economic activity. It would be the useful economic activity. We wouldn't be building more jails for the sake of it. We wouldn't be producing more tasers and weapons for the sake of it. It's just the socially useful production. So on the assumption that GDP could plummet very quickly, all we're talking about is actually to get this sort of convergence, a 5% increase, and then within per year, and then within 25 years, we'd actually have the population of the planet at double its current income levels. Now, there's lots to criticise on that. It's just a sort of stab in the dark at it, to be honest.
So, Paddy, were you with it?
Yeah, I was just one of the bits you skipped in the 2.5-hour talk was population, and it's a bit of a shame you skipped that because I think a lot of people, when we present the sort of idea of socialism, how we can make it viable, one of the first things they say is, well, what are you going to do about population explosion? What are you going to do about this? And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
I skipped it because it's kind of a minefield in a way to get into it. It's also a subject that socialists would never really wanted to get into. I think it's historically, obviously, it's had this sort of association with eugenics and dictatorships and one-child policies and that sort of thing. And I think historically we've always said, that's not for us. We're not going to get involved in that. It may be something that you're further down the line, a socialist society we would have to look at. But of course, it wouldn't be a sort of top-down dictatorial approach that would be taken. But I don't really see it as a problem. Most of the IPCC's projections, most of their scenarios, kind of assume a similar sort of population trajectory. from between, you know, it's going to grow from the current 7 billion to maybe something between 8.5 to 10 billion. So 8.5 is a very conservative estimate, 10 billion is a very sort of negative one. It's not a massive variation, I guess, in the scheme of things. What I find interesting about the population side of things is that there's this relationship that you know, we've known from history that as societies get wealthier, the fertility rates drop dramatically. But it's not actually wealth that's doing that per se. That's actually that's not the actual causal factor. It's the education and the health infrastructure that follows in from that. And you know, socialism would be focusing on those things first of all. You know, we'd be focusing our resources on these sorts of things. So I think we could construct a good argument if we wanted to say that actually we think that shifting to a socialist society where people are leading far less insecure lives, and that's the sort of driver behind, you know, high fertility, isn't it? It's insecurity about the future. We could construct a fairly good argument that said we think the population would probably, under the sort of scenario that we're talking about, would probably be within these sorts of limits. I think when you have looked at societies or communities where there's been an increase in the wealth and nothing else, I think it's in Wales there's been studies done in mining communities where for some reason there was a massive big influx of wealth over a period of time. So it's removing the education and the health aspects, but looking at, if you just put wealth in, then actually the fertility goes up again. So it's actually, and there is some evidence in the last 10 years in some of the richer countries, in the US, some European countries, in Scandinavia, we're starting to see that as these countries are getting richer, the fertility rates are starting to go up. But it's a very mixed bag. It's not happening in Japan, it's not happening in Canada, but it's happening in a lot of other ones, and it's still early days for that, but it's a possible reversal of that historical trend.
There's one technological development I can think of that is one of those sort of emerging things, one of the things that you sort of sometimes hear about, but it's never sort of quite yet there yet, and that's 3D printing. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on how that might impact either is the future of capitalism or its possible role in a socialist society. Because 3D printing would certainly reduce fuel costs if you can just print out something instead of it being transported to you. Although, of course, 3D printing still involves lots of plastics use, unless you can 3D print in materials other than plastic. I'm not sure about that. I suppose I could imagine a socialist society where 3D printing would enable people, especially in more remote parts of the world, to have to sort of order in new commodities without the same transport hassles that you would have otherwise. So I just wonder what your thoughts are on how 3D printing, either in capitalism or in socialism, might impact not only on wealth distribution, but also on climate change and sort of use of resources.
Okay. I don't know very much about that, to be honest. I think the thing with maybe a more general point, I think the thing with capitalism is that innovations they happen quite slowly and awkwardly, and things jump ahead when there's a sort of cluster of things come together at the same time. Industrial capitalism needed you had the mill and the coal coming together, and also some capital, and that suddenly sort of, there's a sort of synergistic thing happened there, and it just flourished at that point. A similar one is electric cars at the moment, I mentioned very briefly in passing there. So that's been around as an option for a number of years, but there's been improvements in battery capacities, and capitalism is now putting in the infrastructure that you need in terms of charging points so people have confidence that they'll be able to actually charge it up. So it's technology, you know, I think capitalism doesn't work very well with technology because it doesn't really easily see the bigger picture, I think, whereas a socialist society we will see the bigger picture. So in terms of cars and such, I'm sure we would be looking, you know, electric cars, that's fine, but we'd be looking at, you know, heavy emphasis on public transport, surely. I suppose on your specific point about 3D printing. There's this whole sort of argument about sort of localising production so you can get your own energy generator, your own photovoltaic cells on your roof that would charge up your electric car and it'd be off the grid. So you can see why capitalism is uneasy about this sort of thing, that, that in a sense the means of production, yeah, we're selling the means of production, but you've now got control over it. You know, they're not happy that we have some degree of control over the internet and peer-to-peer information exchanging and such like. So you can see how they're maybe not that happy about 3D printing. But to be honest, I don't really know much. I couldn't comment much more on it.
Any other questions? Paddy, you want to come back? Yeah.
Just a couple of things. I think the thing with 3D printing is you've still got to transport the materials it's going to print with. So there is that. Well, there is quite a lot of potential to printing metals and printing circuit boards and that sort of thing is coming in. The first military drone has already been flown. It was made out of printed, 3D printed parts. So they printed it on site, put it together and flew it. So yeah, there is a huge potential. But the other thing I was going to ask is about, you mentioned about battery technology. Battery technology is one of the big roadblocks, in fact, to renewable energy. I think it's one of the main reasons why more progress has not been made on renewable energy. And where I live in Manchester, everybody's mad keen to lock themselves onto tractors to stop fracking explorations that will now be okayed by central government against the wishes of some people in the Lancashire area. So it's become the big cause celebre up there. And, we even in the Socialist Party, we don't seem to know what we think about this. We've got members of us mad keen to that we should be opposing it. We've got other people saying, look, no, we're not pushing our position on it. But given the lack of progress with renewables, mainly owing to the battery problem, fracking is becoming a reality. It's like, countries are sitting on piles of money that are just under the ground. The anti-frackers are saying, leave it there. Why would you? So, I don't know, do you have a view on any of this?
Don't really have a view on fracking, to be honest. I think it's just part of the whole energy mix, isn't it? I mean, the argument that's put is that it's better you're fracking than you're digging up coal. And there's always going to be this argument of, well, we could be polluting the world worse if we use coal. So at least fracking's a bit better than that. And it's shifting things down towards the clean energy end of the spectrum. But I guess it's kind of... these are all debates for capitalists to have. I think we can say that, you know... There's been no democracy in this. There's been no consultation, or where there has been consultation, it's a loud raspberry that they've got, and they're riding roughshod over it. So we can certainly comment on issues like that. I'd feel very nervous about us sort of siding with any one particular technology as opposed to any other one, because you just know behind it all, there's just grubby politics going on and backdoor deals and all the rest. That you don't know who you're cozying up to if you're siding with, you know, that nice guy who's doing the electric cars, whatever, he seems nice and all the rest of it. But, you know, all these budding capitalist entrepreneurs, they seem nice when they're on the way up and they're small and they're fighting the big bad corporate capital. But, of course, as soon as they get to the top, they're all a shower of bastards there as well.
I'll just make a point on... battery technology, because I think it's an example of the research and development and resources that go into it under capitalism. That is the reason why batteries are still so rubbish now. You know, why electric cars are still just becoming practical for most people. You've got that problem. Nowadays, you pull up at a motorway service station and you'll see cars having their recharging their batteries. That's taken ages to come along. This could have happened 40, 50 years ago. But even now, you have to, it's not like filling your tank with petrol, it's all over, you pay for it, you drive off again in 5 minutes. You see people plug in the car and they're going and have a coffee and paper and whatever. Anyway, they need a half an hour to do it. But it all comes... My point, what I'm trying to make is when we get into socialist society, our resources for like research and development in, say, energy, you know, how to which energy sources to use, and the energy mix will be decided on, I think, purely on technical or social factors. What happens under capitalism, especially in energy, as it tends to be at the dictate of prices. So, for particularly the price of oil and oil products. So, as the crude oil price bobs up and down, so the enthusiasm, you know, the money available for fracking, or carbon capture and storage, or any other energy sources, it goes up and down in reverse of that. So, you know, in capitalism, we may get cleaner energy eventually. You know, eventually, capitalism may have to do this over the next 20 or 30 years because the environment's going to be in such a state that we will do it, but only because it's become profitable to do it. In socialism, we've cut out the money. We can look at it in a more rational and planned way.
Good point, yeah. Anybody else want anything? If not, can I just come back to the population thing? Paddy in his talk yesterday showed that slide where population was going to go up in the next, I don't know, 20, 30 years to a certain point, and that apparently was what people agreed generally. What occurred to me then was that population forecasts have always been wrong. They've always actually been a lot higher than population has actually risen. Whatever sort of data has been used, I remember in the 1970s the party was vehemently opposed to the all these organisations which were predicting that we were all going to hell in a handcart because populations were going to rise vertiginously and there just wasn't going to be enough to go around for that reason. And in fact, you know, what was that book called, The Limits to Growth, that was written in the early 70s? I mean, it proved to be completely wrong. And generally speaking, as has already been said, population growth tends to go down as what you might call wealth and what's associated with it goes up. So, you know, perhaps we shouldn't be too trusting of these population forecasts that people think will influence the way capitalism develops in the near future. Obviously, in socialism, we'd have a completely different setup, and whether population was an issue or not, is debatable. Perhaps it wouldn't be, because as things stand now, if resources were used rationally, we could not only feed the current world's population, it's well established. Oxfam have sort of made this clear, but probably sort of twice the world's population. I don't know if you have any comments on
No.
Would anybody else like to raise any points? Yeah, sure.
I'll elaborate if you want me to, but some of the things that you were talking about earlier, about sort of, you know, like local, if you want, local economics, local production, you know, say transport costs and all the rest of it. The Green Party, I'm sure probably most people are familiar with the kind of policies that they expound. Since we know the capitalism is not going to collapse of its own accord, it needs a lot of help to get there. But why is the Green Party marginally, or even larger than marginally, more popular and gets more electoral support than the SPGB with the policies that they, you know, I mean, they some opponents of the Green Party, and I don't think this is non-PC, But I mean, they're described as melons, aren't they? Green on the outside, red on the inside, as if they're, and that's an instance because that's kind of like, well, the policies you're putting forward, they're actually, oh, guess what, they're socialist policies, you know, and that's not liked by some people. But I just wondered why, you know, they kind of tend to, and I know this support isn't as, you know, high as maybe people hope once upon a time. I know this support is higher in other countries, but. You know, good, bad?
Indifferent. Why are the Greens not... Why are we not as popular as the Greens?
Yeah.
I suppose. The Green movement has come from nothing in the last sort of 30, 40 years. I think it's fair to say that's that period of time there's been a massive upsurge in environmental awareness, so you can see where they've come from, but mostly they haven't really had, they haven't entered power, they have no prospect of, so I suppose they're in that sort of enviable position that they can promise the earth, quite literally, so that might be something to do with it. And when they have actually gone into power, I think in Germany, I think in Brighton, the council they had there, then suddenly they're up against the reality that they're having to vote for certain measures that they didn't really like. So maybe part of the support for them is, you know, they haven't actually been tested yet, I suppose. That's one thought. They are offering a range of single issues, I guess, linked together under the sort of environmental banner, and so that's always helpful. You're offering sort of concrete, do this, sign this, vote for this, and you'll get this. And we know it's not that simple, it's not that straightforward. There have been some environmental successes in the past. Capitalism has been able to concede reforms. Acid rain used to be the big one in the 1970s. That's not an issue anymore. Depletion of the ozone layer, that used to be a big issue. That seems to be sorted now. The newspaper last week reported about North Sea cod fish stocks are now sustainable again. So, you know, it's not all doom and gloom. Capitalism can solve certain things, but it tends to do it slowly, belatedly, piecemeal, partially, and it very often just creates another problem in the process. I suppose just when you're talking about the Green Party there, one of the things that we should probably expect, I can remember when I joined the party, it was all around the time of CND, and that was the big issue, and you can't be talking about socialism. This is an existential problem. We're going to blow up the planet. Let's deal with socialism later on. Let's sort out the nuclear weapons problem. Now, of course, things have moved on from then. That's, nobody really talks about that anymore. I don't believe we're any safer now than we were 30, 40 years ago. I don't think we're any safer at all. But the sort of flavours moved on, and the political agendas moved on, and the activists have moved on. They didn't manage to do much with that. Let's look at something else. And the next one is going to be climate change, presumably. We will probably be told, socialism's all very well, but you're going to have to deal with this in the meantime. And that's where we have to, I think, be developing our arguments to say, no, actually, socialism is the only solution to climate change. I don't know if that answers your question.
Perhaps I can just add, Brian, that when my branch of the party stood in an election a couple of years ago, we had against us a Green candidate. We also had against us one of these Tusk candidates, you know, Trade Union Socialist Coalition candidates. Both candidates got more votes than our candidate did. And why was that the case? Well, as I see it, it was the case because they were both reformists. They both stood on reformist platforms of trying to improve certain things within capitalism. And the fact of the matter is that the working class is more attuned to voting for those for platforms like that at the moment than for actually getting rid of capitalism. So, I think, you know, the reason why the Greens are more popular than we are is the reason why other political parties or organisations who are trying to reform capitalism in one way or the other are more popular than us as well. That's the way I would see it, anyway.
Yeah, I'm just thinking that, perhaps the Greens are socialists, but, in a way, as we've perhaps demonstrated over the weekend, the environmental issues are very serious, as Brian said. But and I sort of wondering, whether the sort of say that the Greens and the Tusk and us, that they're familiar with the Greens and they're familiar with Tusk. Sort of if there's somebody you've not heard, you haven't heard of them, you don't know what they are, and it's only a brief explanation. I suppose I'm a sympathiser, largely because of my concerns for the environment.
I think we would recognise that within the Green Party, as distinct from lots of other political parties, there are lots of socialistic ideas, perhaps. But it wouldn't add up for us to then being a socialist party that you mentioned there. But I think there's a lot of sort of common ground, perhaps, there in terms of concern about the environment and attitudes to capitalism and economic growth and that sort of thing.
They don't say that much about the socialist aspects, do they? They're promoting the green bit, so...
Yes, so...
It
was just because you mentioned that they're a socialist party. I think we draw a line on that and say, they might be anti-capitalist party in some ways, but there's plenty of them that are not anti-capitalist for that matter, but wouldn't say that they have a sort of coherent socialist objective. But.
I just wanted to say that I think the Greens are offering something that seems doable, whereas when we put our case forward, it seems so incredibly undoable that people just can't sort of relate to it immediately. And I think what Howard was saying, that reform seems to be the more acceptable option.
Sure.
I guess that's the reason I'm trying to at least make the prospect of revolution a less daunting one, an achievable one, see some sort of logical process. The more we can do of that, I think, will help our case.
Don't you think the growth of the internet and mobile phones and things and communication gives rise to the fact that socialism's a possibility right here? I think years ago, before the advent of the internet and communication, it would have been a lot harder to have a socialist world. I think the internet and communication and ideas spreading quickly can happen faster now than they've ever happened in the past or whatever. And you've got a problem in the world. There's a lot of people who are religious. And there's a lot of people who live in countries where they don't have any democracy, like China and places like that. But the internet and things like that might help solve that, and move us towards the possibility of a socialist revolution.
I think we've had lots of discussions about the internet over the years and the pros and cons of it. I think it's kind of work in progress that the working class are still getting to sort of learn how to properly use it for their own purposes. I certainly see it as a positive thing. I can remember when I first got interested in production for use in the 1980s, it's Peter Lawrence was the driving force behind that, and I stayed at his house once and he had all these documents and papers from the World Health Organization and all sorts of stuff, and it was a gold mine. You just couldn't get this sort of stuff. Now you just couple of clicks and you've got more information. As I said, I had a two-hour talk yesterday. You have more information than you could possibly want, and that's fantastic from our point of view. That is ammunition for our point of view, so that's certainly good. In terms of the communication between the working class, I know Paul Mason, in his book Post-Capitalism and his other books, he's talked a lot about mobile phones as being a sort of revolutionary tool in the hands of the Arab Spring protesters. That's possibly only so they could organise demonstrations. It doesn't maybe take it much further than that. But I think in general we are getting much more used to this idea of networked communication with each other, and we're learning how to do that and how to, how to filter out the fake news and actually use this as our own means of communication. Because certainly we have to, we have to get beyond the sort of mainstream media. I used to send letters into The Guardian and it's a great success when I get a letter in. I think, what's the point of that, really? It is kind of pissing in the wind. We just need to create our own media, I suspect, rather than trying to use theirs.
Well, we've had quite a good run, actually. Unless anybody has got a final sort of burning question to ask, perhaps You have, Paddy.
I add a little rider to what you said about the state of Peter Lawrence's. I stayed at Peter Lawrence's around about that time, or a bit before that, where his first paper was going to eventually turn into socialism and practical terms. And he said, what do you think? And I said, I think you might not have considered the developments of modern technology quite enough. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, you've not used the word computer.
Did you type it on one?
Oh,
you did a manual typewriter. Oh, yeah. That's a good point, Paddy. Okay. Well, can we thank Brian for his very informative. Yeah, do you want to say something, Alan? Yeah, go on, all right.
Yeah.
Final word?
Yeah. I'm talking about a piece of video. It's just a 12 minute by accident. Just this morning I found it. And if you want to listen to it, we're talking about a history of our enslavement. Will give us an idea to how to make a progress against capitalism. Is that you? Are you available to listen to? Just 12 minutes.
Piece of video now. Well, can I suggest we finish this session and then people who would like to listen to it can stay and hear that? Shall we do it like that?
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Right. Well. Again, just to thank Brian again for his wide-ranging, informative and very encouraging talk. And, you know, we've had a good question and answer session. Yeah?
I don't want to just thank Mike for this fantastic...
I was just about to say, and can we thank Mike for the enormous amount of work he's put into organising, more or less single-handedly, as I could, as I see it. Yeah. Tremendous job. So thanks very much to both of you.
While we're on thanks. Yeah, I'd like to obviously thank everyone for taking the time and effort to come along, and especially all to the speakers and those who've delivered presentations. Yeah, it does take a lot of time and effort to put a talk together. And again, you know, it's not just about the talks, it's also about the discussions we have in the lounge and after a few drinks at 3 o'clock in the morning and all the rest of it as well. So, you know, summer school's it's sort of made by everyone who comes along. So, yeah, I'd like to thank everyone for coming along.